another week begins. This time we get to do it from here in Studio A. We have 3 hours of issues, etc. ahead. Likely no open lines. 3 hours of guests. Greg Kokel is our first guest. He's one of my favorites. We're going to be talking about morality by community consensus. There are other words for this. He talks about Star Trek morality, and we'll find out exactly what he means by that when we start our conversation with him in just a moment. Greg Kokel is president of Stand to Reason. In the second hour of the program, Dr. Norman Nagel joins us here in Studio A. We're going to talk about the person and work of the Holy Spirit. It makes me wonder, does the Holy Spirit desire that we call attention to Him? Jesus tells us of the Holy Spirit, He will take all that is mine and give it to you. He will testify of me. He will not speak from Himself, but He will take what is mine and give it to you. Does the Holy Spirit desire attention drawn to Himself? We'll talk about that in the second hour of the program. In the third hour, we'll talk with one of the co-authors of our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for June. June is rapidly winding down. The book is called Christian Ethics in the Workplace. Jim Truesdell will join us to talk about understanding work as Christian vocation in the third hour of Issues, Etc. Our phone numbers are 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727. Feel free to give us a call with a question or comment as we talk about morality in the first hour of Issues, Etc., especially morality by community consensus. Greg Kokel is co-author of the book Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Mid-Air. He also has written an article in the latest edition of the Solid Ground newsletter titled The United Nations and Star Trek Morality. Greg, welcome back.
Hello, Todd. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Greg, what do you mean by Star Trek morality?
Well, faithful Trekkers will recall, I think, the prime directive of the Federation, which prohibits the crew of the Enterprise in Star Trek from interfering with alien civilizations. And the idea there is that the Star Trek crew, with their, you know, earthly perspective, has their own morality, but other civilizations have a different morality. And that morality of other civilizations is just as legitimate for them as ours is for us, and therefore they are directed not to interfere with that morality. Now, of course, if you watch the show, you know those guys interfere all the time, which makes part of the fun of viewing that. But at least the directive implicitly declares that morality is something that is relative to a society. So our moral principles might be true for us as Americans, or in their case as Earthlings, but when it comes to another culture, an alien culture, for example, they may have a totally different moral point of view, which is just as legitimate for them as ours is for us, and therefore we are not justified in interfering and imposing our view on them.
So it seems as though this view of morality would say that the basis for morality is what?
The group. The group is the one who decides. In any kind of relativism, morality is relative to some subjective standard. Now, the subject may be an individual, like you have your view, I have mine. That would be kind of the crudest form of relativism and the most dangerous. A less crude and less controversial notion of relativism is that, no, it's not everybody can do whatever they want. Everybody has to obey rather his own culture's understanding of what's right or wrong. So we have a kind of a social contract. It's the group that decides. Now, when you go from one group to another, you may have varying ideas about what's moral or what's right or what's wrong, and we have an obligation to respect that. We don't push our view on some other culture, just like the prime directive from Star Trek, but ultimately it is one's own group, one's own the consensus of one's relevant community that is the final arbiter of what's right and what's wrong.
I was, just for light reading this morning, perusing the Supreme Court decision regarding the Texas sodomy law that came down Thursday last week, Lawrence et al. V. Texas. And I was looking at the dissent from Justice Scalia. And one of the things he pointed out about the majority opinion was that, look, the court had decided that because in the last 17 years when they last revisited this subject, since then, the culture of the United States, the prevailing opinions of the United States have changed radically on the issue of sodomy. They were justified in overruling, essentially, themselves. Is this decision, at least as far as I've described it here, based in some sense as an example of a morality that is based entirely upon group consensus?
Well, in the illustration you gave, in principle or theoretically, it could mean one of two things. It could mean that what has happened in the last 12 or 15 years is that we have zeroed in more accurately as a culture on what is actually right and good and true. Okay, like for example, maybe we thought slavery was fine before, now we don't think it's fine. It isn't a matter of just changing our moral principles as the culture changes, but rather through a process of education, we are now more in tune with what has always been the case, that in that case slavery was wrong, or maybe in this case that homosexuality is right. That would be a very charitable reading. That would be a way of reading it in light of kind of a non-relativistic worldview. I'm not inclined to read it that way because I actually think the sentiments there expressed by the courts are more like what you're suggesting, that our social climate has changed, our attitudes about what is right and what is wrong have changed. 20 years ago, this was wrong for us, and now, 20 years later, it's right for us. Incidentally, just as an aside, it's a pretty bold statement for the justices to now be able to declare what everyone thinks is right. The fact is, everybody doesn't think that homosexuality is right. The majority doesn't. But there has been some softening in that. And so now the court is, by fiat, declaring what the public ought to think is moral. And therefore, I think they really are representing this kind of Star Trek morality point of view, the idea that culture determines what's right or wrong. That determination is usually embodied in some kind of law. Now we see the culture shifting in their view, and where homosexuality wasn't right for the culture in the past, now it's right for the culture, and now we have the justification of enshrining that in law, ergo this decision on Thursday.
Now, I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, because I am jumping ahead in your argument against this Star Trek morality a bit, but I think this is a good place for you to explain something you say late in your article on Star Trek morality in the United Nations, and that is according to this conventionalism, this moral standard set by the culture, mm-hmm. moral standards can never improve. They can only change. Explain that.
Well, one has to, in order for one to say that a moral point of view has improved, whether one's own or a culture's moral point of view, there are a couple of things that just simply have to be in place for such a statement to be intelligible. Let's say you're a bowler, okay? And you say, gee, I've been bowling for a long time, and finally I've broken through a plateau and I've dramatically improved my game. Well, what has to be in place for such a statement to make sense? Some kind of system of excellence, of measuring the excellence, and so you can measure your behavior against that system, say in this case a scoring system with a perfect score of 300. And we know that the bowling has improved because now you've got a higher average. Or as a batter, you have a higher average as a batter, and so your batting is improved because you have some measurable standard. So in order for improvement to take place, there has to be some external standard by which your behavior can be measured. Now, with that in mind, when a culture makes a decision about what's right or wrong, what is the standard that determines what right or wrong actually is? Now, the way we've been discussing in Star Trek morality, it turns out that the culture itself is the standard. So there is nothing external to the culture by which the culture can measure an improvement of its morality or a reversal in its moral value. And since there's no outside standard, but the culture is the standard, it's the equivalent of trying to pull oneself up by one's own bootstraps kind of thing. If it turns out that morality just is what the culture decides, well, then the culture can change their decision. They can change their morality. They might believe in slavery in one point and then not believe in it in another point. But that's not an improvement because there's no external standard. There's no external scoring system to measure this change as better or worse. They have just decided one thing that they thought was wrong in the past is now right, or vice versa. And much like what you see in the Texas, the decision regarding the Texas sodomy law from last Thursday, it was a change. But this can't be construed as an improvement unless there's some kind of external standard to measure by. And this is exactly the standard that's denied in this way of doing morality.
Where do the United Nations come into this conversation when it comes to a morality determined by community consensus?
You know, I got to thinking about this, Todd, in April and May during and prior to that, and all the discussion about whether or not we should go to war. And there were many people for whom the deciding factor of whether or not we should go to war was the United Nations. That is, all things being equal, no other factors changing, if the United Nations, that is our international consensus, said yes, then it would be morally legitimate to invade Iraq. But if the United Nations did not say yes, then it was not morally legitimate to invade Iraq. And here you can see, and this was a common part of the discourse during that time, and here you see the deciding factor being whether or not there's consensus on the issue. It wasn't a question of whether or not the act in itself by some transcendent moral standard was appropriate, that is, whether this was a just war or not, whether there could be a majority of one, that is, one person could be right in making this decision, even if a whole bunch of other countries, for whatever reasons, disagreed. No, the propriety of the moral choice of going to war is going to be in the larger group consensus, in this case an international group, the United Nations, not the particulars of the circumstance that the United States faced with Iraq in themselves. And that's just Star Trek morality. That's the idea that that morality is determined by a majority vote of the relevant community, and in this case the relevant community is the largest community in our world, politically speaking, that is the United Nations. And if the United Nations says no, that is, if the majority doesn't agree, or the relevant majority in the Security Council does not agree, then it can't be moral. And if no other details change about the reasons to invade Iraq, except that this group of nations agrees that it's okay, then it is moral. That's a dead ringer for conventionalism, for Star Trek morality.
Now, I'm picturing a little conversation here that pushes this just one step further, and that is the person who would say, okay, really, if the morality that was in play there in that circumstance, you talked about ready to go to war with Iraq, was this conventionalism, morality by public consensus or common consensus,
mm-hmm.
how could the United Nations, even as a group, even if they were agreed that it was wrong, impose their view of morality upon the Iraqi regime, who would at least appear to have its own group to decide its own morality?
Yeah, that's an interesting take on this, and it does create a little bit of a problem. I guess the standard way to answer is that in this particular case, it's not one country imposing its will on another country. That would be a violation of conventionalism and the Star Trek morality, and it was viewed to some degree that that's what the United States was doing with Iraq. Who are you to say, kind of thing? You have your views, they have theirs, and they thought they were right in what they did. You think you're right in what you do. Who's to decide? In this case, though, it's a little different, because with the United Nations, we have a step above the local and particular there in terms of an individual country. You have a consortium of nations that represents the larger group over the whole earth. So in this particular way of looking at it, you have this group consensus of which Iraq is a part of the larger group. That is kind of a type of League of Nations of sorts in the United Nations. And so, I mean, it could be cast that way and not be a violation of conventionalism, because now you've kind of jumped up to this higher group level, the authority of this higher group. But you have raised another issue, though, and the issue is, if you're a member of a larger group, and the larger group holds that you ought to obey it, and this is the general consensus, the question could be, why ought any member of the group obey what the group says? It's the social contract idea. Somebody said, well, we've got a social contract here, that we all agree to live a certain way. The United Nations is a part of, has its social contract for its area of influence, the United States for its area of influence, the local community, the family, everybody's got kind of their social contracts. But then the question can be asked, why should any member who is allegedly party to this contract keep the contract? You see, if morality is determined by the nature of the contract, That is, the contract defines the details. Where do you get a morality that requires you to keep the contract in the first place?
Oh, I see what you're saying.
It has to be smuggled in the back door. In other words, you've got to presume a kind of morality before you can explain morality through social contract. And so enforceability is gone at this point. Even if the United Nations is operating properly as a social contract institution, with the Iraq being a member, Iraq could say, what obligation do I have to keep your silly contract?
Greg Kokel is our guest. We're talking about morality by community consensus, sometimes known as conventionalism. Greg is calling it Star Trek morality. Another question rises here, and that is, who is the community that determines the morality? Is it the general population? Is it those, like in the case of Saddam Hussein's regime, it wasn't the general population, but in fact those who were able to wield the most power?
Yeah, is the community just the strongest, or are there relevant communities that we do have some obligation to pay attention to? But what happens if those communities come in conflict? I mean, the concept of community, to be honest with you, is a very broad one. If the broad point of view is we should keep the rules of our community, well, what is that community? Is it the United States? Is it our state? In fact, that was part of the discussion here in the homosexuality, the law that was overturned, the ban on homosexual behavior, on sodomy that was overturned. Does the United States have the right as a larger community to judge on this, or should it be the local communities of the state of Texas? And, I mean, culture is complex, Todd. It has many overlapping internal societies that make claims on us. And behavior that's acceptable at the gym in the morning is not acceptable at a dinner party in the evening. And you have religious communities that are bona fide communities, but then you have business communities, and you might be a member of both. So which group is primary if it's the community that decides what's right and what's wrong? See, culture is not homogeneous, and this makes it impossible to define a common standard of behavior, which shows one of the shortcomings of approaching morality in this way. And you've put your finger on it. What often happens is, when you have all these competing ideas, it's the person who can garner the most power in any given situation that is, frankly, able to impose their view on the majority and establish by fiat what is right or wrong in a culture.
I see another danger here by someone who will say, you're right, Greg. Culture is not one thing, but in fact a complex of many things. Therefore, there can be no real objective. It's just another case for there being no real objective morality, because, of course, even culture can't decide it. It's got to be up to the individual.
Actually, that's an example of circular reasoning there, because if what's at issue is whether or not there is an objective morality that stands above the culture, you can't simply then point at the differences of opinion and act as if the fact of differences of opinion proves what you really are obliged to demonstrate through other means. You can't just say, well, people disagree, therefore nobody can be right, morals are relative. I mean, it just doesn't follow. I mean, you could have one view about the nature of the atom, for example. I could have another view about the nature of the atom. Just because we disagree doesn't mean there's no truth in the matter about the nature of the atom or whether the Earth is flat or round or spherical or whatever. Disagreement doesn't tell you anything about what's true or what's false. I mean, you can go into an animistic culture, and you could see in animistic cultures that they think that spirits cause disease. You can observe that. You can go into a Western culture, and you can see that in Western culture they think germs cause disease as an observation of the fact of their belief in the culture. But by observing in one culture that they believe that spirits cause disease and another culture that germs cause disease, these observations on their own don't tell you anything about what causes disease. And so observing that there are differences of opinion tells you nothing about the nature of the realities behind the issues in question. You can't look at people who have differing opinions and cultures about what's moral and therefore conclude that there is no objective morality. That's just a fundamental mistake in thinking.
This is not a new thing. I mean, it even predates, believe it or not, even predates Star Trek. You cite the Nuremberg trials of the Nazis after the Second World War, where their defense was something along the lines of either I was just following orders or I got permission to do it.
Yeah, that's basically the. We see this thing, actually, it goes much further back than that, but we see, I think, a vivid example of the logical consequence of thinking this way, that a culture is the one who decides what is right or wrong, because then you have, as it turns out, a moral obligation to do what the culture tells you to do. Precisely the defense of the Nazis at Nuremberg. I was just following orders. This is what we believed was right, and I was doing what the authority in my situation told me to do. And the tribunal, of course, did not accept that justification because they understood that there was a law above culture's law. I mean, some things are wrong regardless of what any society says to do, and in this case it would include plundering innocent Jews, pressing them into forced labor, and exterminating them. It doesn't matter whether you were just following orders, you are still doing what's wrong. And see, the court was able to prosecute Nazis only because they rejected the social contract view of morality, the conventionalist view, Star Trek morality, if you will, and acknowledged that there was an objective set of moral principles that stood outside of social preferences, which were violated during the time of the Third Reich, and that these people should be held responsible for that violation.
So whether we see it in the more extreme justifications or rationalizations of Nazis in Nuremberg, or we, in a more trivial sense, we have people saying, "Look, I am only acting according to what the community believes, community standard, what the community believes to be right and wrong."
Everybody else is doing it.
It's really the same morality at work.
It's the exact same principle, and this is why it's helpful to look at the Nazis. Because one of the tactics that we use at Standard Reason in trying to show that a point of view is problematic is a tactic called taking the roof off. It's a term from Francis Schaeffer. It's also called reductio ad absurdum, or just simply reductio, which means to reduce to the absurd consequence. And what you do there is you take a person's point of view and accept it for the sake of discussion. You say, okay, let's just say that your take on morality here is actually true. Where does it lead? Does it lead to absurd conclusions? And if this take on morality is legitimate, then we would have to say that the Nazis were justified in killing Jews when they were ordered to by their superiors. That's what follows from this. And when you see the consequences of this, that all, and this isn't the only one, but there are a number of absurd consequences that result from applying this view consistently, that ought to tell us that something must be fundamentally wrong with this take on the moral enterprise.
Greg Kokel is our guest, president of Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California. If you'd like to receive Stand to Reason's free Solid Ground newsletter, call 1-800-2-REASON, 1-800-2-REASON, or you can check out the website for Stand to Reason by simply going to our website, issuesetc.org. Under that section titled Links with Regular Guests, you'll find a direct link to Greg Kokel, our guest in this hour, and Stand to Reason. When we come back from this break, another pitfall in morality by community consensus, and that is the confusion of what is legal with what is moral. We'll be right back.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
How does a Christian behave ethically in the workplace when compromise and cutting corners seems to be the order of the day? Can a Christian behave ethically and still compete in the world of business? Christian Ethics in the Workplace by Ray Hilgert, Jim Truesdell, and Pastor Phil Lockus is our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June. You can order the book online. Go to our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace. Or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040. The book is $14.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040. The workplace can be an ethical maze. Learn how to navigate it with our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace. 1-800-325-3040.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on gospel breakthroughs in Pakistan among the Baluch. They could be an example of an unreached people group that may soon be considered reached with the gospel. Baluch families in Pakistan and Iran have been Muslims for hundreds of years. There were never more than 100 known Christians among the several million people. But Global Prayer Digest magazine reports that there are now 80 known Baluch fellowships. In addition, several Baluch evangelists and their partners are distributing scriptures. Radio broadcasts in the Baluchi language are helping listeners understand about the life of Christ. And there are seminars on important topics like preventative medicine sponsored by Christian groups. Pray for Baluchi Christians in Pakistan to have freedom in worshiping Christ and making Him known. Pray that Baluchi families will discover Christ's love. Pray for unreached people and encourage others to pray by visiting the website missionvisionnetwork.org. Click on the Encouragement Center.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. They say you can tell you're getting older when you know the answers, but no one is asking you the questions. Along that line, you can tell you are in a bureaucracy when a coworker dodges your questions for needed information and hoards responsibility. Not talking here about personal confidences, but rather your group is responsible for some project, but a coworker isn't sharing necessary information and is hoarding responsibility. Three negatives come from such conduct, according to Tim McGuire of United Feature Syndicate. It tells other workers that they aren't trustworthy, it breeds distrust, and it destroys a feeling of ownership on the project. Speaking spiritually, that hoarder is reflecting a desire, conscious or unconscious, to exalt himself, herself. A biblically based approach would recognize that I am accountable first and foremost to God. Then my God tells me, do not think of yourself more highly than you ought, but rather with sober judgment. Romans 12:3. As we get older, we learn things like this. Is anybody in your shop asking about the spiritual implications of office conduct?
There's so much to do at the St. Louis Art Museum. There are exhibits as the museum celebrates an American summer in several interesting ways. There are classes and lectures of interest to children and adults. Ford Free Fridays can be fun, with the film Yankee Doodle Dandy featured on Independence Day, for example. And by the way, the museum will be open that day. Visit their website at slam.org and find out about an American summer at the St. Louis Art Museum.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., last week's U.S. Supreme Court decision overturning the Texas sodomy law. We'll be talking with Christian apologist and law professor Dr. John Warwick Montgomery and get his take on that landmark Supreme Court decision tomorrow on Issues Etc. We're talking with Greg Kokel about morality by community consensus. Greg Kokel is president of Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California, co-author of the book Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Midair. He's also written an article in the latest edition of the Solid Ground newsletter titled The United Nations and Star Trek Morality. Now, if you have a question or a comment, call us now at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Greg, is another danger in this conventionalism, this form of morality based on the community and its opinions changing as they are, is a basic confusion between what is legal and what is moral?
Yeah, just an aside, by the way, you mentioned John Montgomery. I envy your audience who gets to listen to his treatment of this tomorrow, because he's a fine thinker. In fact, I quote him in my piece here talking about the Nazis at Nuremberg.
Oh, I can't wait. It's going to be marvelous tomorrow.
Yeah, he's a good thinker and incisive, too, so, and spirited as well. So I'm sure it'll be an interesting show. Yeah, I had an attorney once call our own radio show here in Southern California for Stand to Reason, and she offered this challenge. We've been talking about the abortion issue, and she said, when are you going to accept the fact that abortion on demand is the law of the land? You may not like it, but it's the law. And she had this idea that the Supreme Court had spoken, there is nothing left to discuss. And this is what happens when you have a point of view about morality, that it's the culture that decides. There's no transcendent law. It's just a matter of doing what the culture says. Because when the highest law of that society responds with its point of view on something, that's it. That's the highest court of appeal. There's no place further to go. There is no transcendent law to which one can appeal. And so this then ultimately ends up confusing, I think, what is moral with what is legal. As long as the law has established something as right, that's the end of the discussion. It must be moral. And to which I think any of us can ask what seems like a very common sense question when we take stock of our own moral common sense about issues. Isn't it possible for a law to be immoral? Can't we pass laws that we all agree with, yet the laws themselves really aren't right? And certainly we all are aware of this. We complain when we see this. How could the government act this way? How could the courts decide this way? How could the majority oppress the minority in this way? We have this intuition that it's not just enough for the majority to decide to make it right or to enshrine it in law, because it's always legitimate to say, yes, it's legal, but is it right? And if it makes sense to even ask that question, then being legal doesn't make it right. This view of morality must be false.
So those who might be trumpeting to either discuss something like Roe v. Wade or the more recent Supreme Court decision on the sodomy law in Texas, those who might be trumpeting the fact that now the court has recognized what everyone has known for a long time, that is that homosexuality is no longer a vice but maybe even a virtue, would be employing this kind of confusion between legal and moral.
Well, they might be, and what's interesting though about a lot of these cases, particularly the homosexuality cases, because the moral sentiment about homosexuality in this country is still largely that homosexuality is morally suspect, that homosexuals shouldn't be married, and with the exceptions of the East Coast and the West Coast, the majority of the country holds to a very conservative view about this. Yet we still have this appeal based on allegedly what's right by those who are on the other side who are campaigning for the law to change. Well, if our view is the social contract view, the Star Trek morality view, that it is the culture that decides what's right or wrong and common consensus determines that, well then when people are fighting against the cultural consensus, they are actually fighting against what's good by definition and therefore are doing something evil. And so it's just ironic that those who are, in a sense, on the minority of the view right now, the homosexuals, are acting as if we ought to accept their moral point of view when, in fact, it's not the consensus of the culture. If you're going to play by those rules, then let's play by those rules. And you see, people want to have it both ways. What's mine is mine, and what's yours is mine also is the point. So when, in the case of homosexuality or abortion before it was legal, it wasn't the law of the land. People were campaigning on some transcendent grounds that it ought to be the law of the land. Once it becomes the law of the land, that becomes the basis for argument. This is the law. We've agreed. Everybody else, shut up.
So it would be equally unsatisfactory had the court decided the other direction in the Texas sodomy law. And for those of us who believe that sodomy ought to be in those cases, at least on the books, maybe not enforced, but on the books, illegal, it would be equally unsatisfactory for me to say, the court's spoken, the rest of you go away.
Well, if what you meant is that the court is the final arbiter of what's moral, yeah, that would be. And it's not unusual, frankly, Todd, for Christians to play the game one direction when they're holding the cards, but change the rules and play from the other direction when somebody else is holding the cards, or to mix my metaphors, when their ox is being gored. So I was just referring to this tendency on the other side, by the homosexual activists, etc., but we do the same thing. And what's necessary here for both sides, I think, for integrity, and certainly for integrity for Christians, is for us to be consistent with our worldview when it comes to morality, and to argue based on there is a law that's legitimate, we want to argue, because of the moral principles behind the law. It is not legitimate simply because somebody voted.
And so the person,
legitimate because it's a good law in itself.
So the person who says, look, Roe v. Wade should be overturned because most people believe abortion is wrong and that determines morality, is making just as much a relativist argument as a person who says it ought to be right because most people believe it's right.
Yes, they would be, but there's a way to play that that's legitimate, and that is, if I actually made reference to this earlier, if somebody asked me the grounds for a moral decision with regards to law, I'm going to argue based on transcendent morality, okay? Now, if somebody's going to say, no, this is the way it is, like that culture determines what is right and what's wrong, that culture determines, then, say, for example, with homosexuals, then I'm going to say, well, then, okay, let's play by your rules then for the sake of discussion. Even by your rules, you don't win because our culture has, by consensus, decided that homosexuals shouldn't get married. So if you want to play by transcendent moral principle, you don't win. And if you want to play by your consensual rules, those don't work either because you lost the vote. And so as a strategic or rather a tactical issue, I might play according to their rules just to demonstrate that they can't win by either way. But always keeping in mind what I really believe, and I'm certainly willing to assert this, that the ground for all laws has got to be something transcendent, not merely convention.
We talked about this a bit before, but I would like you to revisit it and explain it again for those who may just be tuning in. You talk about this conventionalism, this morality by community consensus, creating what you call the reformer's dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about it.
Yeah, the keep in mind what conventionalism is, and the word convention is useful here when we think about it. By convention, in America, we sit down at the table and our forks on our left and the spoons on the right, and we eat off of plates. I lived in Thailand for 7 months, years back, working with refugees, and if you live in the country, you sit on the floor and you eat on the floor with plates, but you sit at a table. The conventions are different. A convention is something that people agree to live by, but it could be changed because there's no higher law that drives that particular issue. And so when it comes to morality then, on this view, conventionalism, it's a matter what's right and what's wrong is determined by a cultural consensus. Now this is an attempt to explain the moral enterprise. What's morality about? Well, here's what it's about. Now I don't think that's what it's about. I think it's about something else. I think it's about objective and transcendent moral principles. And the way I know that is that this turns out, if you cast this view out and look more closely at it, you run up with all these odd kinds of things that are assaults to your moral common sense. And one is, how do you reform such a society? I mentioned earlier that that you can't really improve a society because there's no external standard that you're matching the society to say that the society's gotten better. The society itself is the standard. So what do you make of somebody like a Martin Luther King or a Gandhi? Or an Abraham Lincoln, or a Wilberforce, dealing with the slavery issue in the UK, who stands up as somewhat like a majority of one, that in a numerical minority himself, standing and he looks at the majority of culture and says what the culture is doing is wrong. If your view of morality is that the culture is right by definition, then when you oppose that which is right, the cultural consensus, in this case slavery, you are actually doing, by force of logic, something that's immoral. And so you have the odd circumstance that this is the correct way of understanding morality, that what we thought were moral reformers, the Gandhis and the Martin Luther Kings and the William Wilberforces of the world, turn out to be immoral people by definition if this system is correct. And there's, when we reflect on that for a moment, we realize, gosh, there's got to be something wrong with a moral analysis that makes guys like Gandhi and Martin Luther King, etc., immoral by definition. It does seem that there can be a majority of one. The role of the moral reformer is to stand up in the midst of society and look at what the majority is doing and to say that's wrong and to call them to some higher external transcendent standard, a standard external to society, and ask society to conform to that. Such a thing is not possible on the Star Trek morality view of morality.
Our call-in numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Kurt, calling from his car, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. I have two questions. The first is, do you believe that we should have, that we should bring negative civil sanctions against homosexual behavior in our law? And the second question is, on what basis do you do you base that? Are you, do you draw your authority from biblical authority, natural law, or your own common sense?
Good question, Kurt. Two very good questions, in fact. Greg?
Yeah, this is a little bit more difficult question, but it first we have to ask the question this. Just because a thing is immoral, does that mean that we should use the force of government to bring sanctions against it? Pride is immoral. Should we make pride illegal and punish by imprisonment people who are haughty and arrogant? I think it's, you know, you're not going to have to think about that very long, Todd, to realize that, gee, there is an appropriate use of law and there's an inappropriate use of law, even when the thing at issue is something immoral. And the reason that we don't make pride immoral, and I mean, I'm sorry, pride illegal, is because by bringing the force of government to bear on every single smaller thing that is immoral and making it illegal and make it punishable, then we have we lose something else that's valuable in the process, and that is we lose freedom. And freedom is an important ethic in the scriptures, and in fact, God allows us the freedom to sin. Now, there are times when the sin is so egregious that that it is appropriate to use the force of law and government against that sin, and that's really the whole issue of public of politics to decide when should we use force to force people to be good when they don't choose to be good on their own. So, at the foundation of this question for Kurt is you have to understand that not everything immoral should be illegal, and the reason is because greater injustice or harm comes from trying to bring the force of government in to enforce a law against this maybe particular immorality than if you hadn't done it at all and just let the person have the freedom to act in a wrong way. My basis for that is the scriptures as well as to natural law and common sense. You don't need the scriptures to know that human liberty is an objective transcendent moral good, nor do you need the scriptures to know that human liberty must be restricted in some cases by threat of force. Okay, then the question becomes, ought we do this with homosexuality in our present circumstance? My personal opinion, and I'm willing to be, you know, persuaded otherwise, but as it stands right now, I actually think sodomy laws, when practiced or exercised, cause more harm than good. They don't stop the behavior, but they give opportunity for a massive amount of oppressiveness of people, and there's, you know, I can go into a lot of reasons why this is the case. It doesn't serve the purpose it was intended to serve, but it has a lot of collateral harm that comes and intrusiveness into people's lives that I don't think it's appropriate for government to do. And part of the reason we have to always keep in mind when we justify a use of law as Christians against something that we deem immoral, the question can be asked, what if the same concepts of law and invasion of privacy were used against Christians? Paul tells Timothy that in 1 Timothy chapter 2 that we ought to pray for government specifically so that we can have an atmosphere of freedom so that we can express our religion in a righteous fashion. And so that has to always be in the back of our mind when we begin to use law to enforce morality. Now, law always is used to enforce morality. I mean, that's the nature of law, to enforce morality. But we have to draw the line somewhere where our enforcement of morality, on the one hand, begins to infringe in an illicit, inappropriate, and harmful, deleterious way on personal freedoms. And that's always a hard call to make, and I respect other Christians who would come on a different side of this particular issue here. But, excuse me, that's the kind of thing that has to be taken into consideration. And my objections in the events of last Thursday were not that the law was overturned. I think it would have been appropriate for Texas to overturn that. But when the Supreme Court weighed in on it, it weighed in with principles and concepts that it went on record as stating that were behind its decision, which caused much more mischief in our society than simply having the Texas legislature overturn that law. And so that's why I'm against what the Supreme Court did.
Now, a couple things here. First, a comment. I tend to agree with you there, Greg, and we actually had an open lines about this some weeks back where I asked the question, look, if these sodomy laws will not be enforced, do they still have a place on the books? And some of the callers raised the issue, look, there is a value in law of simply drawing a moral line, whether it's enforced or not. saying this is what we consider to be deviant behavior doesn't mean we're going to put you in prison for you or fine you for it. It just means we consider this to be deviant behavior, a standard function of the law.
Right.
And then I would simply ask, there seems to be an argument here that might be implicit, not on the part of the caller, but I can imagine someone saying, hey, if you're going to make something illegal, if only on the books, then you have to enforce it, you have to fine, you have to put in jail. And that argument is sometimes made against things like the recriminalization of abortion. Uh-huh. Well, what are you going to do, put doctors in jail? What are you going to do, put women in jail?
Well, the answer to that is we're going to do exactly what the law requires in every other case of fetal homicide. We're going to prosecute. I mean, this isn't an unusual thing. Almost more than half the states in the union have fetal homicide laws, which are actionable. And so it isn't like we're, you know, inventing a whole new status of criminality here when we make abortion illegal. It's already illegal in most states, including the great state of California, as liberal as it is. You can't kill unborn children here except for by abortion. So I don't think we have to worry about that particular issue. But here's my response to that rejoinder, and that is that, yes, we do make a statement of sorts when we put something on the books, even though it's not enforced, but we also make a statement when we don't enforce it. It's almost like, okay, we want to make this statement, yes, this is wrong, but it's not wrong enough for us to do anything whatsoever about the law that we passed. And this, I think, then has the additional problem. Not only does it nullify the first statement, because now your inaction gives another statement, a competing statement, but it also, I think, causes us to take a cavalier attitude about the law. What's the point of passing a law if we're not going to enforce it? So I think that the net effect is negative there as well.
Now, finally, on this morality by consensus, we are talking, by the way, folks, with Greg Kokel about morality by consensus. Does it have a tendency, essentially, to turn morality on its head? You talk about a confusion of selflessness and selfishness.
Yeah, this is when it's specifically when somebody argues the social contract. And I raised the question before, given this conventionalism idea, the Star Trek morality, that every culture has its own moral code that we have to keep, what's the incentive for me to keep the law? I mean, you can't say I have a moral obligation to keep the social contract, because it's the contract itself that is the thing that establishes what's good. And so you're going to have to smuggle morality into the back door to imply that I have an obligation to keep this set of obligations. And they don't have any grounds to do that. And so the answer that I often get is, it is in your self-interest to keep the social contract. You see, because if everybody keeps the social contract, then we all function safe, with safety, and there's harmony here, and you can live in a safe society. But of course, that's true if everybody does it. But the fact is, if Greg Kokel breaks the social contract, everybody is not going to follow. The key for me is for me just to do whatever I want and not get caught, you know, and then I can experience the benefits of the social contract that everybody else is keeping, and also do whatever I please. And I can especially do that if I'm at the top of the social order and I have the power, you know, like I'm the dictator or I've got the gun or something like that. But even at its most foundational level, that kind of appeal is an appeal to, you should be good because it's selfish. You should do what is in your self-interest. Now, that's an odd take on morality, isn't it? That morality is reduced to self-interest when it just seems that morality entails the opposite, that we ought not be selfish. Isn't that what our parents teach us? You know, isn't that what we teach our kids? Isn't that at the heart of many moral virtues, the idea that we are not thinking of ourselves, that we are not haughty, that we're not self-centered, that we're not egotistical, but we are caring for other people's needs? And so this way of looking at it in an attempt to explain morality actually turns morality on its head, as you said, and it turns out to make morality the opposite of what we think morality actually entails, selflessness. Instead, now it's selfishness. And this is another reason why this couldn't be the right way to characterize morality, the moral project, because it's wildly counterintuitive.
Greg, why is it, if this is so counterintuitive, if it runs against moral instinct, intuition, and even basic logic, why is it that morality by common consensus is so very popular in our culture today?
Well, it's just another attempt, Todd, I think, to get away from what everybody knows is the case, that there is an objective moral law that governs everybody and that we have, and it's external to our culture, it's external to our own personal points of view. It is something that every human being and every human government is beholden to. And now that's awkward. That cramps our style, you know. And so what we're constantly trying to do as fallen human beings is we are trying to get out from underneath the power of that thing. And one way to do it is to try to either deny it or to diminish its force. And so if we can reduce it to a cultural convention, then maybe we can manipulate it more, and then we can get away more often with the moral anarchy that really is driving all of this. Sometimes it's successful, sometimes it's not. What I notice about people, though, is sooner or later they are talking as, without realizing it, as if the objective moral law does indeed exist, and they make use of that when it's convenient for them. They know better, but they're trying to assert their own moral anarchy because that's what they want. They don't want to bend their knee to anybody. I think that's what's behind it.
Greg Kokel, thank you very much for being our guest again on Issues Etc.
Anytime, Todd. I always enjoy talking with you.
Greg Kokel is president of Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California, co-author of the book Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Midair. And he has written an article in the latest edition of the Stand to Reason, the Solid Ground newsletter titled United Nations and Star Trek Morality. You can check out the website for Stand to Reason. Simply go first to our website, issuesetc.org. Under the section titled Links with Regular Guests, you'll find a direct link to Greg Kokel and Stand to Reason. Or, if you'd like to receive their free Solid Ground newsletter, call Stand to Reason at 1-800-2-REASON, 1-800-2-REASON. Jay Bujaszewski says, there are some things that we can't not know. We know them, we don't want to know them, but we can't not know them. We do make every effort to escape knowing them and living by them. Paul says, the sting of death is sin, and the power of sin is the law. We fool ourselves as fallen people if we think that by escaping the power of sin, that is, the law, we escape the consequences of sin itself. Paul says, even those who sin apart from the law are a law unto themselves. They demonstrate that the law has been written on their hearts. It's inescapable. We are held accountable whether we are ignorant of the law or willingly ignorant of the law. Why? Because there is an objective lawgiver who himself holds us accountable. And if that were the only, if that was the end of the story, it would be terrible, except for that this lawgiver has held himself in his own son, Jesus Christ, accountable for our sin. We'll be right back to talk about the person of the Holy Spirit.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.